Today on our Tech for Business podcast, Todd, our COO and CISO, and Nate, our Director of Cybersecurity, join us to talk again about zero trust, but we are focusing on a little bit more business, a little bit more of the ROI. So Todd, can you maybe start us off? Why is zero trust gaining so much traction? I mean, why is it so popular right now? Everybody's talking about it. Everybody's into it. Why is it so popular?
Well, I'll steal some phrasing from one of the vendors we're working with. Essentially, what we're transitioning from is the traditional world was default allow. So basically, if you pass the muster, you got allowed basically everything. And we're transitioning to a new world of deny by default. So you don't really need access to everything to do your job. It just was super convenient because it made it a lot easier for everybody. And unfortunately, the world of cybersecurity has gotten horrible and it just keeps getting worse. And so if you look at one of the better ways of architecting the future, it's the zero trust framework. And we're kind of on, I used the phrase in the past, we're on a precipice of whether or not now is the time. And as people are starting to get better at forecasting and budgeting, now is a great time to look at the architecture of your organization and saying, is this right for the future? I've made the digital transformation, if you want to use the buzz phrases, and I'm now largely leveraging the cloud. But now that the edge of my network has transitioned to the cloud, to remote workers, et cetera, my historical architecture probably does not scale appropriately. Thus, the people are starting to investigate, is it right for now and is it right for the future?
Yeah. One thing I'd maybe just add on top is kind of the why is this concept has been around for quite some time now, right? It was just some of the solutions were hard to implement or very cost prohibitive because they're only available up at the enterprise space. And, you know, here at CIT, where we're talking mainly in the SMB, small, medium business space here. But then additionally, I think there's just, you know, general cultural trends that have also changed why this is happening. So, for example, the rise of Bitcoin, right? You know, Bitcoin was around all the way back in 2011. But it wasn't until like 2017, 2018, right around there, where the price of it started skyrocketing, right? And we've seen fluctuations of that over time. But threat actors said, hey, there's an anonymous coin that I can use to get payments. The regulations hadn't quite caught up quite yet. And then the ease of doing something like ransomware, right? We started to see things like ransomware as a service. You don't even need to develop your own ransomware. You just buy it from someone and you just take, you know, a big cut, you know, let's call it 70% of the cut, give 30% back to the developers. And so it became significantly easier to do these compromises, significantly easier to get paid. Regulations hadn't caught up quite yet. And the impact to the businesses became greater as well. And so that's when, you know, we even saw, you know, the U.S. government, they had put out the executive order improving the nation state's cybersecurity posture. And I think that was back in 2021 now, right? And it was an executive order designed for zero trust within the federal government and the need to actually move their initiatives forward as well. Then we love our marketing team, but marketing across everyone typically uses the word zero trust as kind of a buzzword at this point, right?
Okay.
But there's real intent behind it. And so all of that to be said is it's not just organizations pushing it. There's a lot of cultural shifts that influence why you need it.
Yeah, it's kind of bled into the like zeitgeist and the marketing terms out in the world. So we're hearing it all the time.
And as much as I give our marketing team crap, we do love them.
So. Yes. We're getting all this information out here. When we talk about, or when I hear people talk about zero trust, I always hear it in the terms of like security and cybersecurity. But can you relate it or tell me a little bit more about how it aligns with broader business goals, with maybe how you're sort of running your business with remote work or with the cloud, kind of taking a step away from just security and having that bigger conversation?
Yeah. I'd probably just summarize it as saying business continuity, right? The cybersecurity, there's a connotation of security of we are just the people that say, no, you can't do that, right? And I think that's the wrong approach to cybersecurity. It's the yes, but let's consider, right? And so cybersecurity should be there to ensure that a business continues operating efficiently or, you know, effectively, is saying, we're not going to have a major downtime due to ransomware. We spend our time making sure that backups are operational and everything. So when the event of some type of security incident or outage does happen, we can restore the business adequately and efficiently, right? So that's really the goal of cybersecurity, is business continuity and making sure that the overall risks have been reduced, because you're also trying to reduce the liability back to the business and maybe your shareholders.
Yeah, I mean, kind of expanding on that a little bit, depending on where an organization is, in theory, organizations, whether they have documented it and made it formal or not, is not really important, in as much as they have decided that they have a level of risk they're willing to accept, whether that's measured as an appetite, I have little to no appetite for having a breach, or something along those lines, and then they build their tolerance, right? I'm okay if I spend X amount of dollars to save Y. So inherently, most organizations have that. And so once you start to understand that, that business alignment starts to become pretty clear. But there are other things that are out there, too, that really drive it. I kind of mentioned it with the edge expanding, is if you think about it in the context of the flexibility that it adds to an organization, depending on what their goals are. And that could be anything as broadly as I'm trying to transition off of the traditional IT that's in-house because it's hard to manage and update and blah, blah, blah. Or I'm trying to reduce costs, or I'm hiring internationally. Regardless of what those objectives are, they potentially get better protected and gives the flexibility, is where I was going with this, to the organization by having zero trust in place. So as I was kind of highlighting, and we've got tons of podcasts on this already, zero trust in and of itself is really designed to give the organization the ability to do the things they need to do. If you need to put your stuff in the cloud, great, no problem. If you got people remote, that edge is protected no matter where it is. So that type of business goals can then be quantified and protected by zero trust. There are other things too that you can kind of look at too, but again, this really is driven by what the business is looking for. So for example, your organization may want to say, I want to reduce my IT spend, and there is a perception, real or not, that going to the cloud by default ends up being more expensive. There may be a perception that the more I invest in cybersecurity, I have to spend more and more and more on top of it. As you look at zero trust platforms, there's variances of it. We'll call SASE as an example, where you're looking at securing the edge. A lot of those tools combine the packages into a single offering. And so you have the ability to reduce the number of solutions, if you will, into a single package, and you usually get economies by scale by doing that. Is if you go all in on a single package, your costs will typically decrease. So that potentially is another business goal of reducing or minimizing the cost of the investment. There could be some other things too that are a little bit more harder to quantify, but there could be some things out there too of, as an organization, I'm going to use manufacturing in this example, that I have to become compliant with CMMC. So if I'm working with the Department of Defense, I need to build my security. A business goal and a potential ROI, which is ultimately where we're going, and we can expand on this later, would be I'm going to land a contract with the U.S. government that's worth $10 million. My IT investment is nil, but if I don't come compliant, I won't get that $10 million contract. And I'm just going to throw all mythical numbers here, so don't pay attention to the numbers. You're going to have to go through the vetting process on your own. But hypothetically, if I then am saying, well, I'm going to buy some tools, I'm going to buy a SASE solution, I'm going to do some implementation, I'm going to spend about $150,000, you can quickly go, for $150,000 investment, I get $10 million. That's a pretty clean, easy ROI. So I've got the ability to, A, get compliance, which is partly where I was going, but B, it also really helps me drive ROI. We can dig into that a little bit more, but I know I've been talking for a bit, so I'll take a breath.
And the maybe the one thing I'll just touch on is you had mentioned it a little bit with the SASE and the packages that kind of incorporate multiple avenues of security and like the services with that. I'll pick on one So for example, in the traditional model, and this is why I said in the past, it used to be extremely cost prohibitive, is in the past, if you're trying to inspect like network traffic, right, you would have, okay, we have our firewall, then we have our SSL inspection solution, then we have our antivirus, you know, like intrusion detection preventions solution. And you'd have to like scan the packets at each appliance on your network as it's going out. And then if one of them fails, you know, maybe you bring down your network and, you know, all this type of stuff, right? These new packages, you know, or the solutions on the market, you buy the one and you can set it off once. It scans it simultaneously across all of their engines, and then it goes out to, you know, at the extremely limited latency. You can configure these to fail open in case it is offline. And then you just pay your subscription, right? You know, for the cloud solution. So you don't have to pay necessarily your internal IT to maintain all these appliances or maintenance costs. What happens if one fails and now you have labor? So moving down this direction and focusing on the tools that are designed for it make a lot of sense when it comes to, you know, replacing like hardware with software. So.
Yeah, I'd love to drill down a little bit more into this cost savings, because I think that's the conversation people sort of want. And again, everything we're talking about is hypothetical because we don't have insights into your business as you're listening, but we can give you broad ideas. What I'm hearing is, you know, there's maybe a little bit of setup and implementation for Zero Trust, but then I could get more business and then reducing risk. And it just feels like this scale. I mean, at what point am I really going to start getting that return after I have to invest in all the tools and the time and the energy? Because it does take that.
Yeah. But...
go ahead. Yeah, I was going to say the easiest ROI would be the one where I made the example is if I implement the tool sets and then I start to get business out of it. So again, just kind of clarifying that is a lot of them will be written into the contract as a request for a proposal or whatever. But if you don't meet these standards, you won't get the business. So those ones are pretty easy to understand. If you've been on the path and you've made your investment, once you sign the agreement, you're basically there. So those ones are pretty straightforward and easy to quantify. There's a lot of other stuff that's out there that's a lot harder to quantify. And some of them are spread out over the course of years. And for what it's worth, there's tons of studies out there. I was reading one from Zscaler that got into the details of the likelihood of a breach decreases by roughly 55%. That's great. But if you start contemplating what that looks like over what period of time, is that 5 years? Is it 10? What does that look like? And so that return is a lot harder to physically measure and say, yeah, I can stamp that on there and say, because I did this, I know I saved whatever, $250,000 because I avoided a breach in 2025. Those ones are much harder to measure, but that doesn't mean they don't exist.
Yeah, touching on that, and then I'll kind of circle back on why I was also laughing before speaking was in order to help quantify some of the models of how much should we spend to reduce risk or, you know, and keep that stuff. There's something called the FAIR model. So I'm not going to get into too deep into this, but it is a model that's designed to quantify cyber risk and be able to make decisions on what do we need to continue doing and what's our total exposure, you know, dollar wise. So the reason why I was laughing before was I want to use Todd's favorite term is it depends. And the reason why is, Ariel, you had asked, how much do I spend before I finally start getting the ROI? And the reason why I say it depends is, it depends on what solutions you're putting in place, right? Mm-hmm. And so you can, I'll go pick on vendors that say, hey, yeah, buy our solution, we're Zero Trust, and if you buy us, then you're done, basically, right? That's a load of BS. Not one tool is going to accomplish the needs of Zero Trust, right? It is a holistic approach. It's a cultural shift, that type of stuff. So you can go buy very expensive security tools that really don't offer you much protection in the long run, right? You need to be strategic with the ones that you're putting in place. This is one thing that I think CIT has actually done really well. We have taken a look at software stacks. We've taken a look at what is actively going to mitigate major risks and still be able to drive the business forward at cost-effective price points with ensuring that we don't have a lot of overlap between tools, right? And so one of the big things that we use is the Cyber Defense Matrix. It's designed to help break this apart for you and make those educated decisions of where to start spending your money and where your still deficiencies are in your security posture, right? So you can do it strategically and get a faster ROI off your security stack if you're purchasing strategically. Just a couple dollars, you know, maybe that I can throw out there as well, because Todd had mentioned Zscaler and like a 55% reduction. There's a lot of data out there that say, hey, the average cost of a data breach is like $4.5 million these days. Depends on the size of the organization. That is true, you know, as you continue scaling up. In the SMB space, it's going to be closer to that, like $100,000 to $300,000, right? You know, the where your losses come from is the cost of your insurance deductibles, if you do have to pay lost revenue, you know, and then also, you know, reputational damage if you have customer churn that comes off of a security incident. So it, and then all the remediation work to actually, you know, kind of address and resolve the security incident in the first place. So think $100,000, $300,000. From there, you can start calculating what are the costs of our security solutions in place to then reduce the overall cost. So if we think that you're going to have a security incident over, you know, maybe once every 5 years with all of these security solutions in place, you know, you can calculate. Maybe that's a $50,000, $60,000. I'm not doing math in my head right now. It's $1,000 a year potential exposure, right? If we put these tools in place and it costs us $8,000 a year, maybe our potential exposure drops to about $15,000 a year, right? And so that's how you can start figuring out, am I paying for the right tools to be able to protect us? Lastly, and then I promise I'll stop talking. There are like IANS put out, you know, a study of how much people are spending on cybersecurity in various market segments. And so if you are in a more regulated industry like financial services, they tend to spend the most on cybersecurity in terms of their IT budget. So I think IANS posted that it was about 14% for the financial services. Healthcare was lower than that. They were about 8%, I believe. Now that might be changing because there's a lot of HIPAA proposed rules. The HIPAA proposed rule is trying to make them act more as like a financial services. So they might need to increase some of their spending. And then manufacturing is going to be significantly lower typically, unless you are in that DoD, you know, CMMC space, then your investment needs to significantly increase. So,
well, one thing I'll add on that, and if you've listened to the podcast, you've probably heard me say this ad nauseum, but I'm going to say it again, is even though the requirements may not be high today for your particular organization, it's coming, right? If you look at how almost everything is written, and I'll use the Department of Defense RFP that I mentioned earlier as an example, is the way that's written is whoever you're working with has to have the same level of security as you do. So that trickles down immediately, right? So that's your vendors, that's your suppliers, it's everyone, which ultimately means everybody's going to be under the same scrutiny. And you can already see some of that's happening. This was going to be my other example of an ROI, but you can see that happening in the world of cybersecurity insurances. They're starting to, I was going to use the term, put the screws to people, and that's probably not appropriate because that's not what insurance companies do. They help you reduce risk. Thank you to your insurance people out there. We love you. But what they're trying to do is they're trying to help you through the process and reduce the risk. And in this particular case, if you're paying attention to risk, this is a risk mitigation of transferring the risk to somebody else. But where I was going with this, as Nate was kind of highlighting, as you're doing your investment, the insurance companies have a very good idea of the things that reduce the risk. And so they've got a playbook for all intents and purposes of the tools that they're looking to have in place. And if you meet those, you will see the reductions of your costs with your insurance on a regular basis, your premium expenses, if you will. And that could be, I was talking to an underwriter yesterday, and his metric was roughly, if you check all the boxes, you'll see a 30% reduction in your insurance costs year over year. So it's fairly significant. Now, if you're not spending $100,000 on insurance, it clearly doesn't pay for all of your tools. But it is one of the factors that should be considered as you're going through the process of justifying the tools being in place. In the end, yeah. I think by far the biggest two in my book of where you're going to realize the ROI to address the question you asked earlier is going to be, can you get a contract because of it? That would be the easiest one. I'm generating revenue because I've done it. And then number two is going to be the fact that you've mitigated the risk of ransomware or some sort of security event. As I mentioned, though, I just want to put the, it is a little fluffy because it's hard to say because I didn't have one. It was definitely because I spent X, Y, and Z dollars. It most likely is true if you're paying attention and you're going through the process in a methodical manner, but it's harder to do it. Oh, and one last thing, getting back to the FAIRS, is FAIRS factor analysis for information risk. So that's what it stands for. If you're curious, when you want to go and Google that.
Thank you. That was just for me because I need to Google that. I love it. Well, so what I'm hearing is we're reducing risk. We are becoming compliant or making sure that we're staying compliant. We're getting business because of that. We're potentially reducing risk from insurance costs. Is there any, can we shift to internally? Is implementing zero trust changing our efficiency internally or changing what our employees are doing day to day and what they're spending their time on? Is there any ROI there?
Possibly.
There is. Yeah. I was going to say, yeah, there is. I'll let Nate talk, but I just had to put my one little quip in because I can't help myself. But I would hesitate to get too terribly far into the nitty gritty. So for example, when you've got somebody doing that inside your organization, one of the examples we used to have in the good old days was if I had a printer in my office, I would save whatever, 2 minutes from walking down the hall, picking it up, coming back, et cetera. And therefore, over the course of the year, I saved us, myself and the organization $10,000. That's a hard ROI and difficult to justify. But I'll let Nate talk and then I'll add on to anything if appropriate.
Yeah, to be so wishy-washy. But again, it depends. The security is all about, you know, there's a little triangle. For those that are listening, you can't see I'm holding up a triangle, but at one tip, you have security. Down at the other tip, you have usability. And the other one is functionality. So you're always trying to find the balance within that triangle of where you want to be. Are you more leaning towards the security? Because if you are, you're going to sacrifice possibly some of the usability and the functionality, right? And so in terms of like productivity and efficiencies, yes, you can impact the usability and the efficiencies depending on how functional or how secure something needs to be. Likewise, you can balance it and find a healthy balance for whatever the risk tolerance of the organization is. Are there efficiency gains that you can get? Absolutely. So for example, let's go pick on software approvals in your environment. If in the past you had to put in, you know, like you gave everyone local admin to their machines. If you're listening, the worst thing you can possibly do, don't do that. But if you do, great, you're super functional and you're not very secure, right? So then you say, oh, let's just rip out, you know, this local admin and now an IT admin has to go put in their credentials, you know, every time they have to do a new printer driver or something like that. You've now killed the efficiency in the sake of security. There are solutions that sit kind of in the middle there that offer both, right? And so that's where then software approvals, now you're reducing IT admin labor because you're letting the tool just automatically do like pre-approved actions. And so that's where you can really gain those efficiencies. Likewise, I'll go pick on like our favorite, like the SASE solutions, right? There's some good ones out there, but let's say you're doing an acquisition or a merger or something like that, you could spend significant amount of time trying to tie these two businesses together to start building out, you know, how, you know, maybe someone needs to access one system and the other company and one needs to access the other one. You can build this together to say, if you're in organization A, you can access just organization B's system without having to grant full access to the corporate network. Likewise, you can go from company B to company A's resources and keep them fairly segmented. but secure, you know, with that. And so you've kind of reduced the overall burden because it's extremely easy to set something like that up. Lastly, efficiency gains with zero trust is, you know, let's talk about just like identity, right? Identity is something that is near and dear to my heart. And being able to say, how do we ensure that our HR system is always reconciled with our identity solution, whether it's something like Okta, Azure, Active Directory, you know, Google, you name it. When you build out a zero trust approach to your identity, is that automation directly feeding from your HR system is going to be extremely powerful. You've reduced the overall labor because now your IT admin doesn't have to always go spend all the time reconciling data, making sure that people are still employed or terminating. They can be terminated automatically. All the updates that are happening from the HR's perspective can automatically sync downstream to your identity solution. So there's a lot of considerations when it comes to this. But yes, overall, you can improve efficiencies. You just have to find that healthy balance for the business.
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said. And I was kind of going down this path as well in my head of where I wanted to go next. And so I like the identity one as an example, too, is to answer your question directly. Yes, there are additional savings. And the internal ones, I think, are actually kind of fascinating to some degree if you're a nerd like myself, especially if you look at the IT department. So I'll use an example of staying with identity passwords, for example. If one of your initiatives inside the organization is to go passwordless, we have another podcast for that. You should tune in. It's a great, great episode. But if it were to do that, one of the major things that you can get rid of is the fact that you have your staff resetting passwords on a regular basis. And while that doesn't sound like a big deal, the number of passwords, at least for CIT, it's significantly, and it's not even close, the highest things that we work on for our customer base is that password reset. There's tons of studies. You can just go Google it if you want to see the average, but the costs could be, depending on the size of the organization, upwards to $1 million if you're talking at the enterprise level of savings per year. But there are other things too, as Nate was kind of covering. If you're looking at VPN, VPN is historically, it's all license-based, but it also is heavy tech support requirements. And so as you start to transition off of those traditional tool sets, you start to realize efficiencies elsewhere as well. So the answer is yes, but you do need to be somewhat conscious about what you are trying to accomplish, right? You can't just go in going, I implemented zero trust, therefore I saved the organization $1 million. You have to say the initiative is, I am going to do X, Y, and Z, and now you can create the metrics that will help you measure that to determine whether or not you were successful.
Yeah.
I mentioned the infrastructure cost could be decreased just because you are consolidating your tool sets. But going back to that a little bit further with the passwords in addition to is, and Nate's example for that matter, is you've built in efficiencies throughout your organizations. And even though I kind of poo-pooed the people walking down the hall to pick up a piece of paper off of the printer, it's legitimate. If I don't have to call tech support to get support, even if your support is incredibly inefficient and they can do that in 5 minutes, you still wasted 5 minutes times however many times that is per year. But if you're like most organizations, it's, hey, I called, they didn't answer. They called me back, but I was away from my desk. That ends up adding up to significant amount of times. And so you start to gain efficiencies rather quickly, and you on average start to see an increase of your employees' availability. I will, again, caution, we made this comment during the AI comments as well, is some of that is soft, it is squishy. So what did that person do with the half an hour time that they got back? I couldn't tell you. That's going to be dependent on your organization and how efficient your employees are. But there is savings there.
I'm hearing longer lunches. I'm just kidding.
Sure beats a half an hour one.
Yeah.
You guys get lunch?
Lunch?
Yeah.
I have AI and I still don't get a lunch. So
the life of a cybersecurity professional. Oh man. Well, I want to make sure that we cover anything that you want to cover, but as we sort of come to a close, we have talked on other podcasts implementing zero trust and making sure you're doing it in the best way for your security. So now I'm interested in how can you where do you start with Zero Trust if you want to do what's best for your security, but also what's going to kind of jumpstart that ROI and get that best business benefit?
I'll do a real selfish plug here is talk to CIT. We can help you out. But then additionally, we did a whole series of podcasts on Zero Trust and the maturity levels. And I don't remember the exact definitions, but let's call it like baseline, right? Is here's where you are today. Then there's an intermediate step, and then there's an evolving step, an advanced step, and optimal step. I hope those are the correct terms. But basically, we walk you through each level. And then in each level, there's also kind of pillars based off of, is it the identities? Is it the devices? Is it the data? Is it the workloads? You know, and kind of approaching all of those topics together. So selfishly, go back, listen to those other podcasts. I'm sure Ariel would love to link those in the show notes, but that would be a great spot to start.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we've got a lot of stuff out there. There are some negotiations, or I'm sorry, some things that are we considered non-negotiable. So there are things that, like, easy stuff is the stuff that the insurance organizations are looking for. So those are easy places to start getting wins. But in the end, I think it is going to depend on the organization. I hadn't said it yet, so I was obligated to fit it in there somewhere. As your organization starts to build the plan of what they're doing and what their expectations are, that's really going to help align where the best place to start is. For us, it almost, at CIT, we basically say it all starts with identity, right? If I can identify the device, the person, the location, I've really put myself in a good position to start to defend the organization, our data, and so forth. So that's typically where we start, but we do have a lot more information in some of those other particular podcasts. I don't remember the names of the stages either, but those should be definitive enough to kind of get your arms around where to start and what to be looking for.
Now I've got to look it up.
I know. I see on Nate's face. He's going to look it up right now. I'm trying to think. Optimal.
Here it is. Traditional, down to the bottom, initial, advanced, and optimal. There's four kind of tiers to them.
Perfect. We got it.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to touch in on this topic of Zero Trust and ROI?
I think Nate covered it really, really well. I mean, I think we covered the topic well. But again, if you need help, there are people out there. Obviously, CIT is by far the best one to choose. But if you need assistance, there are people that can help you through the process.
Yeah. I would just, as a reminder, if you're looking at solutions, there's a lot of vendors out on the market that say, we do it all. Yeah. Cut through that a little bit. You know, there are some that do it better than others, but just making sure that you're being very strategic with the solutions that you're putting in place. Zero trust is such a buzzword. So again, we can help you through that as well.
Perfect. Well, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed this topic, please let us know. Like, subscribe, or reach out to us at info@cit-net.com or head out to our website, cit-net.com/podcast. We'll be back next week with an all-new episode.